Please be seated. Oh, good morning. It looks like we have another full house out there. Before I call the second case of the morning, my notes tell me that we have students from Horning Middle School. Is that the case? And if it is, would they please stand with their teacher? Oh, wow, wonderful. You may be seated. Thank you so much for joining us. We like to have students come and hear oral arguments so they learn a little bit about what the Supreme Court does. The students are here under a program that we maintain with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class, so they have received some information about the case prior to joining us. After this case is over, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley on my left will meet with the students and talk with them a little bit about court procedures and any other pearl of wisdom she wants to give them. She won't talk about the substance of the case, but just to help them understand a little bit more about what the Supreme Court does. Now, I should probably introduce the court to you students since we've gotten a little bit of a look at you, so I'll do that. On the farthest right is a chair where usually Justice Rebecca Bradley sits. She is not participating in this case. Next to the empty chair is Justice Annette Ziegler. In the empty chair next to me, generally, Justice Shirley Abrahamson sits. She also is not participating in this case. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Again, next to me, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who will be your friendly tutor when this is over. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. And on the far end of the bench, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those brief introductions, I will call our second case, McKee Family versus City of Fitchburg. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, Attorney Matthew Fleming of Murphy Desmond, representing McKee Family One LLC. Over 100 years ago, in a speech to the New York State Bar Association, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes stated, "We must think things, not words, or at least we must constantly translate our words into facts for which they stand, if we are to keep to the real and the true." What Justice Holmes was talking about in this speech was the danger of following rote repetition of legal formulas, because he recognized that, in his words, they do not represent a final analysis, but dodge difficulty and responsibility with a rhetorical phrase. Further, he noted that they allowed dictum to survive as law in the particular case, while the principle upon which it would have to be justified has been destroyed. That encapsulates really what I believe this case is about and what is happening with the building permit rule as applied to developments of this kind.
Do you think that our law is dictum with regard to the building permit rule?
Well, first of all, I don't believe it's dictum. As I indicated in my brief, frankly, I think that the strict application of the building permit rule under the Lake Bluff housing case is best read in the context of the procedural posture of the case. That case was mandamus, and what the owners were looking for there was mandamus ordering the issuance of a building permit. And it makes sense that where you have to have a clear legal right to order the government to do a thing, issue a permit, you first have to establish that you have satisfied all the requirements to allow you to get that permit. In that case, they had their building permit did not comply with the existing zoning or the previous zoning that was initially in place that they wanted to proceed under. So from that perspective, I don't think it's dictum. To the extent to which that building permit rule has been applied is the problem, because it is ignoring what the fundamental purpose for the rule was and for the theory of vested rights. I mean, the fundamental principle behind vested rights is that people should be able to know the legal consequences of their actions before they act. Settled expectations should not be lightly disrupted. I've placed up for you a couple of pages from the appendix. As you can see here, these two lots here are what we're talking about.
and this is at the plat of Chapel Valley. Chapel Valley, as you can see on this lower map, in that cross-hatched area, right next to it is McKee Farms Park. This was all farmland.
If you would wait just 1 minute. Counsel, do you have any objection to his using the demonstration in the courtroom? Okay, thank you. Please, go ahead.
So this was all vacant farmland, which the McKee family, along with a lot of other lands in the area, sought to develop.
Those two lots that you showed, are those 53 and 54?
These are lots 53 and 54, and right. These are 10 and 11. I think that's 10 and
so 53 and 54, were those originally going to be Pleasant Valley? Chapel Valley? Chapel Valley assisted living?
Well, originally, you start with the Chapel Valley plat. I don't think there were any specific users in mind initially for those lots. When this was initially platted.
Well, I recall from the briefs, and I prepared for this a few days ago, and we've had my memory is that there was going to be, or there was talk or discussion or plans of, and I remember seeing the street view for assisted living facilities.
Well, there was an assisted living facility that eventually was built, I believe, on lot 11 that did cause a change in the initial plan development ordinance that was required in order to do that. But in the original plan development ordinance, the plan was to market most of the multifamily to seniors, not necessarily assisted living, but apartments that would be more catered towards seniors.
And was the senior living, whether it was assisted living or some other kind, was that going to be placed on lots 53 and or 54?
Well, I think at that point, senior apartments was a concept that they were looking at for all of the lots. However, it was clearly also in the GIP that the developers were not committing to doing senior housing. That was simply the plan at the time. And when the city of Fitchburg later rezoned these lots out of the PDD and into the RM, medium density zoning, staff acknowledged that at no time was that the promise.
I appreciate right. your implicit compliment, but speaking for myself, instead of using the acronyms, would you please state the full thing?
Sir, PDD refers to Planned Development District, or sometimes referred to as PUD, Planned Unit Development, which is a kind of zoning which is essentially made up between the city and the property owner, where they negotiate. It has to be imposed by agreement.
I want to follow this up because the fluidity that you refer to in the telling of the sort of morphing of the original idea of senior living into something else, as I understand it, rather nice looking from a consumer standpoint. Nice-looking apartment complex idea. It seems to me from my recollection of the briefs, that sparked some pushback from some of the citizens, which ultimately resulted in resulted in some pushback, which resulted in a rezoning decision.
Correct, although it's tough to tell really whether it was the transfer from senior to other apartments that was the spark, because
it doesn't matter. The municipality made the decision to rezone, and that's
right.
what brings us here today.
Right, because from the initial
and PD, so what I'd like to do is try to pinpoint I think at the forefront of my mind from page 2 of your brief on when you start talking about the agreement. And that sort of sets up my expectation that at some point I'm going to see an agreement allowing for the kind of development development that your clients have in mind, most recently for 53 and 54. But what I think the closest that we actually get is the what stems from the 1989 transfer of the, let's call it 60 acres of land for park use. Okay, so we have the dedication of the 60 acres for park use, and then in exchange, the municipality grants and promises that at some point your clients will be able to develop up to 600, what are sort of in a sterilized fashion referred to, sterilized but memorable term, dwelling units. Okay? So, other than that sort of, let's call it a sort of general promise, shall we? And that kind of, and that makes sense under the circumstances, because no one can predict the future. No one can predict what the living needs of the people of Fitchburg are going to be. No one can predict the living needs of any locale for the next 30, 40 years. So can you point us to any more specific agreement other than Exhibit B, which seems to sort of narrow it down to a certain locale, which happens to encompass 53 and 54, to say, yes, here is the promise, this is the specific promise, performance of which they have breached? And my answer is going to be, my guess is that your answer is going to be no, otherwise that's what you would have put on page one of your brief.
Well, my answer is no, although it's a little more complicated than pointing to just to one part. Ultimately, the agreement and the expectation that we are asserting today that we ought to be able to go and develop under is the planned development zoning designation that was given. The planned development zoning designation adopted what is in the record as the general implementation plan. Actually, that initial general implementation plan was general with respect to two of the lots, and it also included a specific plan for Lot 10. But even that general plan, the record, it sets forth extremely specific criteria for what is anticipated to be developed on each specific lot. And for Lots 54 and 53, there was specifically planned in that general development plan the ability to develop up to 132 dwelling units. There were conceptual layouts of how apartment buildings might look there. There were parking ratios, densities. So all of that stuff was laid out. This was not a general commercial or zoning sort of thing. This is a very specific ordinance that says what is going to go here. And when you look at the City of Fitchburg's planned development ordinance, it specifically says that once that GIP, the General Implementation Plan, is adopted, that becomes an agreement between the city and the property owner. Right, it actually uses the term agreement.
Yeah. All right, Councilor, I'd like to work you backwards through the development process so we can localize exactly when the obligation arose to allow you to go forward. So at the tail end of the development process, you get a building permit from the City of Fitchburg.
Correct. That's about the last thing.
That's the last step. The step that precedes that is you get an approved PDD SIP.
Correct.
Okay. The step before that is you get an approved PDD GIP.
That is also correct.
And the step before that is you get a PDD.
Well, I believe the adoption of the PDD GIP is essentially the implementation of PDD zoning. So the GIP is really the first stage of that zoning.
All right. So which stage... Just going through that chronology that we just did, at what point did the vested rights arise?
At the point where the council adopted the GIP, because at that point its ordinances say this becomes an agreement between the property owner and the city, and moreover, it goes on later to say that if the property owner comes back later with an SIP that substantially conforms to the GIP, the council shall approve it.
All right. So then let's look at that process there. When the GIP was developed, that encompassed the entirety of what appears on your exhibit here. Is that correct?
The GIP actually only encompasses the large multifamily lots.
10, 11, 53, and 54.
Correct.
Okay. And the balance of what's shown on your map, that was pursuant to prior development agreements.
Well, it was part of the same plat. At the time this was platted, there was zoning put in place because you're starting with an agricultural piece and you need to zone it properly for this plat. So all these lots over here, this has been zoned some form of single family. And then initially, this was given a high-density residential zoning. So it's still fairly specific, but not as specific as the plan development zone.
Right. So you start with the high-density zoning, then you move to, by agreement with the city, to the PDD.
Correct.
All right. Now, is there specific language in the GIP that says that you have the right to develop 53 and 54 as high-density housing without respect to what that housing would be used for?
Well, yes. Yeah. Well, again, the right to go forward is really encompassed in the general plan development ordinance that establishes, as I said, it's an agreement, this is the GIP, and it says that gives you the expectation that a SIP shall be approved if it's in conformity with the GIP. And so looking at the GIP approves it for 132 multifamily units.
Okay.
There was no obligation for those to be senior housing, rental, owner, occupied. It simply indicated you have the right to build 132 dwelling units. Because from the standpoint of land use impact, for instance, it doesn't really matter whether you have a condominium form of ownership or whether it's rental. It's the same sort of people. Senior housing may have different impacts on uses of parks and so forth, but the city of Fitchburg didn't have different standards, for instance, for parkland dedications.
Sure.
Or infrastructure requirements based upon who was going to occupy those units. It was based upon needing to serve 132 dwelling units.
So let's start walking through the vestedness of the rights. So in the GIP for 10, 11, 53, and 54, what was it that the developer committed or did on for the city of Fitchburg that you believe created some vested rights?
After receiving the PDD GIP approval, well, let me back. First of all, the parkland that was necessary, at least certainly in excess of what would be allowed under this RM zoning, was already previously dedicated. That's one thing that makes this case a little bit unusual, because typically in this process, the parkland dedication wouldn't occur until approval of the plat. But because the McKee family wanted to give Fitchburg an opportunity to have a large chunk of land up front to develop a very large, 60-acre park, that's where this prior agreement came in. But...
Well, wait a minute. My understanding from the briefs, and I might be wrong, would be that your client is a well-established developer in the locale, and this is... Am I wrong?
They've developed... great many lands, and as I said, the McKee family's owned a lot of the lands in the area and had been developing it for a while, and individuals within the McKee family, do operate as developers.
Well, yeah, and so it seemed to me that perhaps, so you're saying that the transfer of the land that resulted in the park, that occurred, I thought, in 1989.
Correct. Which is unusual. That's not the typical process.
Right, but that was done.
That wasn't the result of other projects as well. That was in contemplation all of this?
Well, that was contemplation for this particular project and other projects in the area. So that agreement and original dedication.
Other projects that had probably been completed is what my impression was reading the briefs.
Some may have been in the works.
In 1989.
Correct. And also, if you look at the settlement agreement, there were other projects in the works for which other parkland was dedicated. There was stormwater, and that was part of the reason why there was a lawsuit and that settlement agreement came out.
Right. But as far as the dedication of the parkland is concerned, that was done in conjunction with the development of the plat. Is that correct?
Correct. And that's typically what is required. Right. It's in the platting statutes that allow government to ask for dedication of parkland based upon.
Right. In the dedication of that parkland was based in reliance on and in response to the zoning for 10, 11, 53, and 54 being high density.
Correct. Well, because of when this was done, and obviously the Key family over time was looking at, you know, 600 dwelling units is what they essentially bought with that agreement, and so they allocated it out.
Right.
But when they platted this, of course, they knew how many dwelling units they wanted to develop here, and therefore knew how many dwelling units they were going to have left that could be essentially purchased with that previous land dedication.
Okay, so that's the parkland. Now let's move on to the other improvements that you've asserted support your veterans' argument. Sewage, the roads. When was that put in, and where?
Right, as you can see, well, the roads and everything essentially get built as you're ready to begin developing the lot. So when these single family lots were done, I believe this was the first part to develop. Well, as you can see, the lower page here is the page out of the GIP, and you can see some of these roads for the single family development are shown as being developed. So after the GIP was approved, that's when these roads were installed. The record isn't clear as to, doesn't really detail whether, you know, this one would have been first and that one, but you know, these are installed, were installed after you get the GIP approval.
All right, so the parkland was dedicated prior to GIP approval. The roads that you're referring to, and I assume all the other improvements, are subsequent to GIP approval.
Correct.
Okay. Now, what is the basis on which the city can deny an SIP after the GIP has been approved?
If it is not consistent with the GIP. And that's all the ordinance says, or said at the time. Since that time, I found in the record there was an amendment to the ordinance. I haven't analyzed or addressed because it wasn't germane to the action taken at the time. But the ordinance in 2009, it doesn't really give any other criteria other than it needs to be reasonably consistent with the GIP.
All right. And so we're before the building permit. Are you saying that the vested rights arose once the GIP was approved and you took some action in reliance on the GIP in doing some improvements that the city of Fitchburg had expected?
Correct, yeah. Using traditional common law vested rights analysis. And we've also argued quite a bit in the trial court that just the by operation of the statute and the ordinance that the PDD operated as an agreement that we were entitled to rely upon.
Counsel, this is my concern for your argument. I want to put it on the table, and then I want you to persuade me that I shouldn't be concerned. And that is, you, in response to Justice Kelly's question, said that you had a vested right at the time the city approved the General Implementation Plan, the GIP. But your argument in your briefs really bases the underlying vested right not so much as a point in time, unlike the permit rule, but rather vested rights accrue when a party has made substantial expenditures or incurred substantial liability based upon reasonable expectations. And my concern is that expectations, reasonable expectations, is a place without discernible boundaries. And even your test is substantial expenditures. Substantial is, I'll say it less eloquently, squishy. And entities like we're dealing with here, governmental entities, and people dealing with the governmental entities need some specifics, and it seems a vested right accrues when it's based upon reasonable expectations and the party has made substantial expenditures is just too indefinite to be workable, because that's your real test.
Well, I disagree from the perspective that when you apply that in practice and how the development process will go, there's never been any dispute that the money spent and required to go ahead and put in roads, sewer, water, that alone is substantial. But secondly, another important thing that you have to understand is, you know, once the plat even has been recorded, you know, you have dedicated streets, you've dedicated parkland, and certainly once you begin constructing these roads, you have already started going down a path from which you can't turn back.
You may have, but what about everyone else?
Well, that is precisely why, though, that zoning requires that it be done in accordance with a master plan. At the time, it was advisory, but now, by statute, it is mandatory that your zoning be consistent with a master plan. That is why you go through such an intensive process with the preliminary plat and
so
final plat.
I said in my question, I think that this reasonable expectations test of yours is a place without discernible boundaries. Tell me why, show me or explain to me where the discernible boundaries are on your reasonable expectations.
Well, we would like the court to set the discernible boundary at the point that the GIP is approved, because we believe that it's at that point that the city has said, you have everything that you need. From here on out, any approvals you need are merely quasi-judicial or sort of clerical things, or checking on whether you meet building code standards and engineering principles, that all the legislative discretionary act, public health safety that is not established by specific regulations, all that's behind you. Now you can go forward. You can get your financing. You can start preparing other engineering details. You can start marketing the lot. Afterwards, as a practical matter, once you've begun building the roads, and actually have given over land and value, I think is a discernible time period. I think the language that's used in the briefs and a lot of the decisions does sound uncomfortably squishy, just because there's so many different possible factual scenarios. No land division or development scenario is necessarily exactly the same, so stating these rules necessarily requires sort of broad language. But when you look at how it's applied and when you look at some of the other out-of-state decisions that I cited, it really does come down to some common sense fairness principles. Once the city has invited me to step on the doormat and construct all this stuff and put streets where they are and expend money to build public infrastructure to serve a certain type of development, it's got to let me go forward and get the return on that investment.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Council. You'll have five minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Please the court. My name is Lisa Lawless of the law firm of Hush Blackwell LLP. With me here today is my colleague Ross Anderson, also of Hush Blackwell. We represent the defendant, respondent, the city of Fitchburg in this case. Along with us is the city attorney for the city of Fitchburg, Mark Sewell. The arguments of McKee's counsel are very interesting in an academic manner. They would support a law review article that vested rights should be no longer, or that vested rights should not just turn on whether you have a building permit or not.
Ms. Lawless, before my colleagues might take over the questioning, and counsel, I wanted to ask you the same question, so I'm going to put it out there for you to consider when you get back up. What, if anything, do we need to do with Lake Bluff? And it seems like we have a clean rule, and it's good to have a clean rule because then people know what they're getting. It's easy to apply. There's no ambiguity. You're not going to have case after case coming to court for legal determinations on a factual basis as to what's required. I understand those arguments. But if we were to adopt counsel's argument, do we need to do anything with Lake Bluff, number one? And number two, is it really the right way to look at these kinds of cases when in Lake Bluff it really dealt with a building permit? So that was an easy line to draw. But what's fair about having someone go through a development plan process when there's more than a building permit involved? And they really invest in that process and then have the rug pulled out from underneath them.
That's a good question. One of the driving principles of this case as decided by the circuit court, and all the arguments of counsel were not made to the circuit court. The circuit court judge did not get the opportunity to consider whether a special rule should be applied to this kind of zoning, to PDD developments, and whether Lake Bluff and the building permit rule are just somehow inapplicable and not pertinent to this zoning. That argument was not made. So that's really why we're here in an academic manner. The argument is asking this court to issue an advisory opinion that is not in the record in this case. But putting that aside, the answer to your question, first of all, is that the general principle is well established for years. We need to start with the rule. The building permit rule is an exception to a broader rule. And the broader rule is that municipalities have the right to change zoning. The zoning classifications are a legislative action that legislatures, like the Common Council of Fitchburg, it cannot bind future legislatures by entering into contracts to keep zoning the same for many, many years. And so that's one of the principles that must begin in this case. The second question is, you do not get vested rights in the zoning classification. That's well established. And so, this doesn't start with the issue of building permit, not building permit. It starts with the notion that the city of Fitchburg had the right to remove this zoning classification. And then the question about, to jump to the argument that there should be a new rule, if that were present in this case, I mean, I'd love to address it. The building permit rule has the benefit of being a date certain. There's no evidence in the record that a building permit is difficult to obtain. Building permits presumably were obtained for lots 10 and 11 because those lots were developed. It must be kept in mind in this case that we are not talking about an adoption of PDD zoning in year one and then removing it in year three. What we're talking about is PDD zoning adopted in 1994. The lots 10 and 11 were developed with senior housing, assisted living, senior duplexes, a particular type of development between 1995 and 2002. Then lots 53 and 54 sit undeveloped from 1994 when the PDD was first adopted until 2009.
Council, would it make any difference if they had proceeded immediately to develop lots 53 and 54?
Well, if they had proceeded immediately to develop it, we wouldn't be here because they would have moved forward to develop it. They would have got their building permits, and they would have started construction.
Yeah, my apologies. Let me amend that hypothetical slightly. They finished lots 10 and 11. The rezoning happens the next day, and then the McKee family comes along and says, well, we want to do 53 and 54 just like we did 10 and 11. Would that change your analysis?
If the if, for example, they...
Sure. 10 or 11. They develop 10 or 11, right? And then the next day, the city comes along and rezones from PDD to RM. And then the McKees come and say, well, we want to do 53 and 54 just like we did 10 and 11. And we were going to do that, but now you've changed the zoning on this. Does that change your analysis?
Well, if the zoning is changed before the owner starts the process of developing it, before the owner applies for a building permit, the city has the right to change the zoning.
Okay. Now, let me just let you pick up a little bit further on my hypothetical. So the roads were put in for the purpose of being utilized not just by lots 10 and 11, but 53 and 54 as well. So they've actually, just assume that's true, right? So there are roads there, well, just for my hypothetical.
Okay.
Let's assume that they put in roads that would be usable by lots 53 and 54, and then you change the zoning. Can't McGee come back and say, well, wait a minute, we were in the process of developing 53 and 54, just like 10 and 11, and we would have done that, but for the zoning change. Does that change your analysis?
If nothing is done on lots 53 and 54 and building permits aren't applied for, no, it really wouldn't. But I'd like
then
to...
So then the question is, what is the purpose of the building permit rule?
The building permit, it's really not exactly a rule. I mean, it is an exception to the rule that's absolute, that the municipalities can change their zoning. And the challenge to a municipality who changes their zoning is claims can be made that the zoning was arbitrary, capricious, it exceeded the municipality's power, or there were other reasons why the rezoning was invalid. And those claims are made, can be made. But the courts defer to the municipality to change their zoning classification.
Right. So let's assume that's the general rule. Municipalities can change their zoning. But whether we call this a building permit rule or an axiom or an aphorism or whatever we want to call it, it's there, right? What is the justification for it? Why does that exist?
It exists because the states in the United States, some states, the question is, generally speaking, the owner of property does not have vested rights in a zoning classification. They can't just rely that the property will always remain zoned the same. There is an impetus on the owner to move forward and develop if they want to take advantage of the then existing zoning classification. So some states apply you need to get a building permit for that complies with state law. Actually, let me back up. You need to apply for a building permit, and your application needs to comply with the zoning regulations and requirements. So
right.
it's not really just be obtaining a building permit.
Right.
If you apply for it under Wisconsin law, that's the moment when the vested rights are fixed.
And isn't the reason for that is an objective manifestation of an intent to develop the property?
Yes.
Okay, so why is it not also an objective manifestation of the intent to develop lots 53 and 54 that you put in improvements that could be used by lots 53 and 54?
Well, the Wisconsin courts have considered whether they might apply a test where you consider equitable facts such as expenditures and reliance expenses on your zoning classification, and the Wisconsin courts have held that we will not apply an equitable test. That kind of test where you're looking at, well, what expenditures have you made? So I haven't applied for a building permit, but I've spent money getting ready to develop, so I should get vested rights. That is a completely unworkable rule.
Okay, let's say that's true, but let's say that what we have here is that roads were installed. How is that not just as objective and ascertainable as an application for a building permit?
Well, I'd like to back up. The evidence, this is a case coming from summary judgment, and the McKee bears the burden of proof. On summary judgment, there were documents put in the record, the 1989 document, the 1990 settlement agreement, the 1992 subdivision agreement. The McKee is not a party to those documents. The McKee in this case did not obtain ownership of lots 53 and 54 until 2007. And so the McKee in this case doesn't have the right to argue reliance by predecessors in title, primarily
Why not? They bought all the interests from predecessor in title. Why wouldn't it be their vested rights as well as whatever other recorded rights existed at the time?
Well, for one thing, Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record is connecting those agreements to lots 53 and 54, or for that matter, there's nothing in those documents that says I'm providing park dedication. We're entering into the settlement agreement in consideration for us entering into PDD zoning. Those two things have nothing to do with each other in the sense of the record. There is no affidavit testimony from anyone with personal knowledge who was parties to those agreements who could explain the connection between those agreements and lots 53 and 54. As we argued in our brief, those agreements related to a number of different subdivisions, not simply lots 53 and 54. And so on summary judgment, McKee made the argument on summary judgment. We really need to back up and look. You know, this court, reviewing a decision on summary judgment applies the same methodology as the circuit court. And this can't be avoided. And in the first step in that analysis is you need to look at the complaint of McKee. And in this case, the complaint does not make a claim for vested rights under common law.
Let's say that's true. And before we back up any further, because I think I'm going to get lost, can you tell me, do you agree that that road appears to run along the edge of lots 53 and 54? Does that actually exist?
I went down it last night. Yes, it does exist.
Okay.
And it serves all the properties to the west of there as well.
Yeah.
And there's single-family developments where you see all the squares with single numbers in them. There's above that is PD. And all of these developments are senior housing, except for the single-family homes.
Hang on just a second. Was that road installed before or after the PDD GIP was approved?
That's not in the record. On summary judgment, the plaintiff has the burden of proving their claims for relief. The arguments being made to this court and that were made to the Court of Appeals are a plaintiff making new claims for relief that they did not make to the circuit court. This is not a case where we simply have really bright appellate lawyers coming up with new nuances and slightly different issues to argue. This is a whole changing horses midstream. The complaint in this case claimed that the rezoning of lots 53 and 54 was invalid and void based upon statute 62.23 subsection 7. And McKee argued that statute requires consent to establish PDD zoning and that there wasn't consent to remove the PDD zoning from lots 53 and 54. And because there wasn't consent, the rezoning ordinance is invalid. And that was the first cause of action. In the first cause of action, there are no claims for vested rights under the common law.
All right. Let me just stop you for just a second. So with the PDD GIP, I believe your ordinances describe that as being an agreement of sorts, yes? Uses the term agreement?
Well, that argument was made to Judge Albert in the circuit court based on the language.
The ordinance does use that language.
And it's the agreement, these provide the zoning regulations for this development. Doesn't mean that we're entering into a contract that's irrevocable.
Okay, that's fine. Now, let's assume the PDD GIP has been adopted. Does that create any expectation interest whatsoever in the owner of the property?
Does that create any? Could you repeat that last part?
Does that create any expectation interests at all in the owner of the property?
And what expectation interest for what?
Well, you tell me.
Well, I would say no. And part of this case, when the petition for review was filed, the argument was made very eloquently and dramatically that Wisconsin vested rights law, or the idea of building permit being the date certain when vested rights arise, that law is somehow inconsistent with the law regarding takings under the federal and Wisconsin Constitution, and that under the Penn Central test, you need to consider expectations. That's where the element of expectation arises. Under Wisconsin law, the rule is that zoning classifications can be changed, that you don't have a right, you don't have a right to rely on it or expect that it will never change. So the law has been clear for 100 years that a Wisconsin landowner cannot expect that their zoning classification will not change before they apply for a building permit that meets the requirements of the rules.
But the city could do something that would, some might call in an agreement, that could raise expectations. Isn't that correct?
The law is that municipalities are not supposed to enter into contracts that bind future legislatures, the future common council. And if there is a statute that allows the creation of a contract right, I think like you're describing, the argument, I think, is that this PDD zoning language of the statute requires consent of the owner to adopt it. And that there's the argument that that creates some kind of contract right, but the language of the statute provides that it may be amended or repealed. And so as a matter of expectation, the PDD zoning itself is set forth in a statutory context that provides and allows a municipality to eliminate it. So this isn't a situation where we have some kind of contract between parties, just like any commercial contract. The only basis on which the PDD zoning was adopted was under the statute. And McKee's claim for relief, the first one to Dane County Circuit Court, was that by the terms of that statute, 62.23, and the Fitchburg zoning ordinances, you have to have consent of the owner to remove the PDD zoning. And the parties briefed that extensively. McKee, as a matter of fact, itself moved for summary judgment on that very claim, that the ordinance is void because there wasn't consent. That was their claim for relief. They did not make a claim for vested rights. You see in litigation all the time, when you have some kind of dispute over zoning changes, a landowner would make a claim for vested rights. They would put it in their complaint. In this case, they might put it as an alternative claim or an additional claim. You need to make the claim in order to give the circuit judge notice that you are claiming vested rights. In this case, McKee argued vested rights based on the concept of the ordinance, and Judge Albert carefully analyzed the statute and decided that consent isn't required and the zoning ordinance is valid.
Well,
and that wasn't appealed.
If
I could just interject a question.
Oh, please.
Justice Kelly, thank you. There are two claims in the complaint.
Yes.
The second one is a constitutional takings claim, as I read it,
yes,
rather broadly. Is there any way that plaintiffs can prevail if they can't prove a vested right under some theory on that second takings claim? So what I'm asking you is, don't you have to have a vested right before you can argue there is a taking?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, the Wisconsin law regarding vested rights and the building permit rule is consistent and goes hand in hand with the federal law regarding takings. There's some argument in especially the reply brief, there's an argument that the rule about vested rights and zoning classifications in Wisconsin maybe should be a multi-factor rule because Penn Central is a multi-factor rule. But Penn Central it sets forth a group of factors that are considered to determine whether there is a regulatory taking from when you reduce the ability to develop. The property can still be developed, but the density may be lower. And under Penn Central, courts apply the three-factor test to determine whether there is a taking. One is, what's the nature of the government action? In this case, there wasn't an occupation, there wasn't a literal taking. The second question is, what is the economic impact of this change? And in this case, the McKee did not argue to the circuit court their taking argument was completely conditional on the invalidity argument. And there is statements by their counsel in the hearings that if the rezoning is valid, then we don't have damages from taking. And so the takings under Penn Central, McKee did not argue to Judge Albert, did not cite Penn Central, did not argue we have a taking under Penn Central, and didn't cite any law whatsoever. So on summary judgment, they didn't carry their burden of proving a taking.
Okay, but what there are two different things that can occur in a taking. One can be physical occupation of the property. The other is under Penn Central, you look at, did you really take away all the economic use of this property?
Right.
That second one is what you're talking about here, and that was never argued.
And let me finish the point about whether that's in the record or not, as in terms of the evidence, okay?
Yep.
Even if those factors were pointed out to Judge Albert, okay, and even if they were, which they weren't, there is no evidence in the record, and McKee carries the burden of proving evidence more than all we have here is allegations and argument. We don't have evidence based on personal knowledge from a witness that has personal knowledge of the actual facts they're talking about. We have affidavits with conclusory statements. Like there's a conclusory statement in an affidavit that I acquired this property and I had reasonable investment-backed expectations when I acquired it. No, that is a conclusion of law. That's one of the elements of Penn Central. And to back up, Penn Central's elements, the other one is economic impact.
Right.
And in this case, there is nothing in the record about the price that McKee paid for lots 53 and 54. That absence is fatal to its taking claim under Penn Central. The second thing is that there needs to be evidence of the extent of the interference with the reasonable investment-backed expectations.
Okay, that I get the statement about reasonable expectation and how it goes to taking away the economic loss. I want you just to focus on the other way you can have a taking. If you have a vested right in the property, and what I hear you saying is the only argument that was made about how they had a vested right was based on their claim that they had a right to keep the PDD in place.
Well, Your Honor, under the federal federal analysis of takings, that reasonable investment-backed expectation is the element that we're talking about.
Okay.
And the law in the U.S. Supreme Court is that you look at the expectations.
No, stop just a minute.
Okay.
I've looked at Penn Central and I've written down all the factors and I understand that. But Penn Central focused on a diminution or loss of value of the property.
Right.
Okay. I didn't read Penn Central as having these three factors focusing on whether there was a vested right.
Well, and it didn't, but there's other cases that do. The Stop the Beach case that we cite talks more about the reasonable investment.
Well, I read docs, and that's the condominium, a docominium, I think, that people like to call
about. Stop the Beach is a U.S. Supreme Court case.
Okay. I was thinking about the Wisconsin docs case.
Right.
And so you're saying that other cases besides Penn Central apply the Penn Central factors to see if there's a vested right without being concerned about whether there's a diminution in value?
No, okay, let's back up.
Okay, all right, because I'm...
I'll back up just a few steps. Under takings law, the first question is, do you have a property right? And that's determined under state law, not federal.
Okay,
the second question is...
Just a minute, do you have a property right in what? Do
that,
you
that's
own the
question.
Property? Are you okay? That's
the
what
question.
I think.
Do you
is
have a
question.
Property right? And what are they claiming? They claim we have a property right in lots 53 and 54 staying PDD zoning.
Okay.
And
fine.
It violates the other elements of the reasonable investment-backed expectation. This is where you get into state law, and it's like the Stop the Beach case that we cite in our brief.
Yep.
That holds that you determine the issue of whether there's a property right for takings at the time the zoning ordinance is adopted that they're complaining about. In this case, the expectation, and there's law that holds that the expectation of a landowner, this is an objective test, not subjective. It doesn't matter what their intention was. What you look at is what was the state law at the time the ordinance was adopted. In this case, the state law was you do not have vested rights in zoning classifications, but for application of a building permit that would be approved. And so the question is, under that objective test, McKee did not have reasonable investment-backed expectations. And also, in the summary judgment record, it doesn't put evidence into the record of expenditures, which is more the economic impact, what it relied upon.
Okay, I want you to stop just a minute, because I want to be sure that I understand what you're telling me. I had used the McKee's factor to find out whether there was a regulatory taking, so let's put that label on it. I had not examined the McKee's factor to see if the plaintiffs had a vested right in the zoning they'd like to have had continued. And you are telling me that some cases do use those same factors to see if there's a vested right.
No.
Okay, well...
No, it's the reverse. The federal law looks to state law, and state law determines whether there's a reasonable expectation. And so if...
Okay, just a minute. Okay. I want to focus on the idea of a vested right, mm-hmm. okay? And your property interests are determined under state law, correct? So you wouldn't apply the Penn Central test to determine if there was a vested right under state law, correct?
It's apples and oranges.
Is my statement wrong or right?
Well, but Penn Central incorporates state law to determine whether there's a property right, whether there's a reasonable expectation. And so it looks to state law to fill in whether there's been a taking or not. The issue of vested rights is determined by Wisconsin law.
That's what I was trying to
say. If you have a vested right, you then go through and determine whether there's been a taking.
Yes.
You don't determine if there's been a taking of something that isn't vested, right?
Yes.
Right. So you wouldn't do the Penn Central factors unless you have a vested right.
Yes. And
here's my question.
Right.
How can you have a vested right in something where the negotiations here in 2008, and if I'm looking at the offers to purchase, they were contingent upon the ability to obtain approval from Fitchburg to build on the lots? How can it be a vested right if it's something that the offer to purchase was contingent upon?
Well, the McCormick, the other plaintiff, didn't have, it was held that they didn't have standing to assert a claim because the individual was the party to that, and they didn't have a contract right to buy because the contingency didn't occur. And McKee did not have the right to sell because the contingency didn't occur. That goes to part of the problem, that there's just a complete lack of summary judgment evidence showing the economic impact of this zoning change on McKee. The other point I would raise...
It seems as if in 2008 it was unknown enough to these parties as
good
to whether
point.
They could do it.
Yeah,
right?
That's a good point. The fact that you make it contingent is evidence that you as the buyer aren't assuming that because this is, 14 years later, you aren't assuming that you will be able to develop your multi-unit luxury apartment complex. The other thing that I'll point out is the original PUD zoning from 1994, it does provide that this approval, and it's the GIP zoning, it's not just the zoning for lots 10 and 11. This GIP is contingent or is based upon the plans. The plans are part of our approval. And the plans in this set of documents provide that lots 53 and 54 will have senior apartments. That's what's contemplated. That issue actually is not before this court because the rezoning occurred before the city of Fitchburg would have reached the issue of whether the PDD SIP applied for in 2009 would have been considered to be reasonably consistent. That issue hasn't been decided, and if that issue would need to be decided by the city of Fitchburg. But in this case, to bring it back around...
Before you get to the back around, on what basis may the city deny the SIP if it was filed before the zoning change?
Well, if the city can determine that the application and proposal wasn't reasonably consistent with the PDD GIP.
Yeah. And if the SIP is generally conformable to the GIP, do they have a right to have that SIP approved?
The zoning could change before the SIP is approved.
Let's take the zoning change out of it.
But
the zoning does not change. They apply for an SIP. do they have a right to have that approved if it is reasonably conformable to the GIP?
Oh, I see, I have my red light. That's a hypothetical question that's not present in this case, but I would say using the facts that we know from the record, that at least on the face of it, it's not reasonably consistent because it's a luxury apartment complex.
Right. I'm not asking the factual question. I'm asking the legal question. Does the city have an obligation to approve the SIP if it is reasonably conformable to the GIP?
Well, there's other factors that it considers in deciding that what to approve the SIP. The ordinance allows it to consider several different things in deciding whether to adopt the SIP or not. There could be other reasons why it would be denied. And so it's not an automatic approval. It's not a rubber stamp. I mean, in this case, lots have indicate senior apartments, and the apartment complex proposed was a luxury apartment complex that was not limited to seniors, that would be three stories high with a pitched roof and would have a pool and a clubhouse. That naturally, I think the evidence in the record is alarmed the neighbors that it would be inconsistent with what's already there. But those issues aren't before this court since the SIP wasn't passed upon.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
I think it's important first to understand what we think we have a vested right in. We don't have a vested right to have approval of a GIP or an SIP that's not consistent with the GDP. But we did have a vested right to develop something consistent with the GIP. The money is in the dwelling units. That's what we anticipated. When we decided to build the roads and comply with all of Fitchburg's requirements, the requirements that by their ordinance, by our development agreement, by the conditions of the GIP, they said, this is what you need to do in order to get the right to build up to 132 dwelling units here. When we did all that, we thought at the end we'd get the return on investment. And that's what we have the right to do, to have our application, SIP application, considered under the zoning ordinance that was in place when we began this process, when we changed our position when we invested all this money.
It's another way of saying that you advance that you have a property right in maintaining the PDD zoning?
Well, at a minimum, we have a property right in at least being permitted to complete the development that was contemplated when we began putting this all in. So, you know, zoning is prospective. Non-conforming uses, I suppose they could change the zoning, but the use gets to continue and the structure gets to continue as long as, because zoning is not to be applied retroactively, and that's the real twist here, and why sometimes this concept of vested rights and the relationship of takings becomes a little bit more complicated. You can't have a taking without a vested right. But the reason why you typically don't have to go to the next step of takings analysis when you get vested rights when you're talking about a zoning ordinance is because in our jurisprudence, zoning is prospective only. So the power to zone applies prospectively. So if you have a vested right to do a thing, that zoning ordinance should not apply retroactively because the power of zoning itself is not a retroactive power. And so you, other than maybe having to evaluate a temporary take, you really shouldn't have to get into all the other factors. So you could, for instance, have a situation where you have a vested right to complete a development. Take the building heights cases, for example. In each of those cases, you have a building, at least two of the cases I recall, you have a building that's going up. Arguably, if you go through the Penn Central factor, maybe you don't have a taking if you're not allowed to put on that top floor. But certainly, in that case, the court said, you have a vested right. You have begun to go.
Well,
so
if you have a building going up, you certainly have already accomplished the step of getting a building permit. So I just don't.
Well, but here, that's why the language needs to be put in context. Here, we're not, the endeavor that went on here was not just the building of these apartments. This is a process and investments made to even prepare the land for that that right. We had investments in infrastructure, sewer, water, the dedication of parkland. So the investment, the building of this development occurred much earlier, and that's why the building permit rule makes sense in older cases where you don't have this process. Back where, you know, people came along and the municipality had already put in the streets, the sewer and water is there. It wasn't common practice for the developer to bear the burden to take undeveloped agricultural land and bring it into a developable state. So you're looking at an entirely different process. The building permit is no longer the first thing you get from the government approval. Here it's the last. We've been talking to them for, well, you know, the plat approval process typically takes many, many months and sometimes longer in other places. And they set forth a criteria that says, okay, if you do this and you dedicate this and you build these things, then you get to go ahead and build what we plan on building. We did our part. They took their end of the bargain away. To answer Justice Ziegler's question before about Lake Bluff and what we need to do, I mean, Lake Bluff, really all that needs to be done with Lake Bluff is clarify that that its ruling is limited to the facts and procedural posture of the case. As I argued in our initial brief, really none of the cases that the city relied upon, like Zeely and you know, Rainbow Springs and so forth, when you look at the facts and you apply vested rights analysis that we're talking about, the fundamental basis, really what the purpose of vested rights is, the setting of expectations and allowing people to know going forward what they, you know, are legally permitted to do, the outcome doesn't change in those cases. Some of the language in those cases may change because the language used in those cases is being applied to those circumstances. The outcome doesn't change. Court has not considered this outcome or this situation before. Those state courts that have decided as we have asked this court to decide, and I hope you do.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for fine arguments. Interesting questions as real estate development goes on and on in our state, and zoning does as well. We are going to adjourn now as a court. We will reconvene at... We're going to reconvene as a court at 1:30, and Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will be out to speak with those students who have the ability to remain and chat with her a little bit. Thank you very much.